as they say on the airlines, the attendant has just closed the door. So we ask you to turn off all of your mobile devices, your PDAs, your cell phones, anything with an on-off switch. I love that.
Thanks.
But if you could do that, I'd appreciate it. We will get started. Well, welcome indeed to a program we call Copyright in Motion. It's brought to you by Copyright Clearance Center. We'll tell you all about Copyright Clearance Center. Welcome you here to Book Expo 2010. Delighted to see an audience like this for copyright. I think it's an indication of just how important the topic is for so many of us in publishing. Tell you a bit about who I am. My name is Chris Keneally. I am the Director of Business Development as well as Director of Author Relations for Copyright Clearance Center. My own background is that for many years I was a freelance journalist. So I wrote for newspapers like the New York Times and the Boston Globe. I reported for National Public Radio and for WGBH in Boston, and I'm the author of a couple of books. So among my other distinctions, if you want to call it that, is that I've got some copyrights of my own. So I know the importance of copyright as a matter how shall I put it? When I used to be a freelance writer, I said, I eat what I kill. And in that case, the ownership of my work truly mattered to me, as I know it does to everybody in this room, publishers and authors alike. We've already made the announcement about the mobile devices. We give you permission to turn them off right now. We are recording the program. I should mention as well that among the things that I do for Copyright Clearance Center, I'm the host of a podcast series called Beyond the Book, which is online at beyondthebook.com. You can follow us on Twitter and friend us or like us or whatever it is they call it these days on Facebook. And I promise not to use any of the information we gather about you.
Unlike
the owner of Facebook, exactly. Okay, so let's talk about Copyright Clearance Center very briefly. How many people in the room are familiar or have ever heard of Copyright Clearance Center? That's not bad. That's actually better than it was a couple of years ago, I think. We were one of those companies, for a 30-year-old company, to have been in stealth mode for as long as we were, is a testimony to, I think, the change in copyright from the very beginning of our company in 1978 to how we know it and understand it today. Copyright Clearance Center was founded in 1978 at the moment when the then latest copyright legislation reform took effect. It was the Copyright Act of 1976, but it took effect in 1978. And CCC was founded by publishers and authors to help facilitate permission for the reuse of printed materials, principally in the academic world and in the corporate world. And at that time, the disruptive technology was the photocopy machine. Yes, we all laugh now, don't we? But it's not so funny anymore. What was then known as digital rights management was printing, because it was very difficult indeed to copy anything at all. If you had a printed book, a newspaper article, whatever it was, to make a copy of it meant you needed to buy a press. Once the photocopier arrived, it changed that, and of course we've seen many subsequent changes after that. Copyright Clearance Center is we call ourselves the world's expert on licensing solutions. As I say, we've been around since 1978. In the course of that time, have returned more than $1 billion, $1 billion in royalties to publishers and authors in this country. We have many different kinds of licensing solutions, we call them. If you have any questions about what we do, I'm happy to answer them after the program. We are a nonprofit. We are based just outside of Boston, and we believe that as a nonprofit, our mission is to promote the respect for and the correct use of intellectual property in this country and around the world. Everything we do is online at copyright.com. There's our catalog of works that we have licenses to, but also a tremendous wealth of resources on copyright itself. So we urge you to go there and have a look at that. Tell you about today's agenda, and as you can see, we are trying to keep up with technology here. I understand that the Wi-Fi situation in the Javits leaves something to be desired, which is perhaps a surprise to us all, because this room before our program was taken up with social media and all about Twitter. And it would be a shame if people couldn't tweet. So if you are tweeting on this, we certainly appreciate it. I know many people do follow tweets at hashtag copyright. See a lot on that. So if you are tweeting, feel free to put it under that hashtag, hashtag C-O-P-Y-R-I-G-H-T. Our agenda today, we'll start with some fun. We've got a video that runs about 5 or 6 minutes. We've worked out the technology on that. We'll talk about some of the misconceptions that are out there regarding copyright. It's always a surprise to me that in the world of publishing, there are as many questions and as many misconceptions is perhaps the most politically correct word about copyright. It'd be rather like if you were a dairy farmer to find out that milk comes from cows. I mean, in the publishing world, copyright is the fundamental basis for everything that we do. We'll try to straighten out some things about that. We'll put it into a global context for you, because you'll learn, I think, something that most people don't understand. There is no such thing as global copyright. And finally, we'll take a look at copyright today and tomorrow, or as I like to put it, today and tomorrow.
Gave me the other day. My client loved it.
You gave it to your client?
No. I made a copy for him.
We have a limited subscription to those reports. You can't copy them or distribute them without permission.
Really?
Yeah. Gee, next thing I know...
Oops. Sorry, everyone.
Next thing I know, you'll be posting stuff like that to the web and emailing it all over the place.
We're not supposed to do that either?
No.
No?
Yeah.
Yeah?
No. Intellectual property like published reports, articles, and content you find on the web has to be managed carefully. We have to balance its use with our rights, licenses, and copyright requirements.
I know. I read our copyright policy when I joined the company.
Good. That's a start. But it really comes down to what we do on a daily basis. If you have a few minutes, I can explain the basics of copyright to you.
Okay.
Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution gives Congress the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing, for limited times, to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. It means that in the United States, a copyright holder has some exclusive rights to his or her work. And those rights are protected by U.S. copyright law.
Oh, I always thought no copyright symbol, no problem.
Nope. Copyright is automatic. As soon as something is captured in a fixed format, such as being written down or recorded, it is protected by copyright. Neither registration or publication are required, nor is the use of the copyright symbol. Although, it's a good idea to use the copyright symbol, as it reminds people that the work is protected by copyright.
So what are the copyright holders' rights?
Copyright holders have the exclusive right to copy, distribute, perform, and display their work, and the right to create a derivative work, like when a book is made into a movie. This is why you may need permission if you want to email a research report to your project team or a customer, post an article or a report on a company wiki or an internet site, reprint articles in a company newsletter, post a news story about our company on our website, or make a photocopy of a newspaper article to hand out at a meeting.
Really? For everything?
Well, a lot of things, such as books, magazine and online articles, songs, screenplays, choreography, photos, artwork, podcasts, and software. They're all protected by copyright. But not everything. Ideas, facts, and data are not protected by copyright law. Logos and taglines aren't either, although they might be protected by trademark law. Anything created by the U.S. government is not covered by copyright law. Neither are works for which the copyright has expired.
But what about fair use? If it's for our research, doesn't fair use mean I can use the material?
Maybe. Fair use recognizes that certain uses of the copyright-protected work do not require permission from the copyright holder. Fair use allows for the use of the copyright-protected work for commentary, parody, news reporting, research, and education. The U.S. Copyright Act lists 4 factors to help determine when a use may be considered fair use. The first is the purpose and character of the use. If the use is intended to help derive financial or other business benefit, then it is less likely to be considered fair use. That usually ends the analysis for most business uses. Next is the nature of the copyrighted work. The use of a purely factual work is more likely to be considered fair use than the use of a creative work. Third, an evaluation of the amount and substantiality considers how much of the work was used. Even a small portion may be too much to qualify as fair use if what is used is the heart of the work. And finally, fair use considers the effect of the use on the market or the potential market. If your use is likely to result in economic loss to the copyright holder, then it is less likely to be considered fair use. None of these factors alone is enough to determine fair use. You have to weigh all four in order to determine if the use is really fair use.
Oh.
This stuff is confusing. For example, many people confuse the physical ownership of a book or a CD with owning the copyright to that work. The first sale doctrine permits lending, reselling, disposing, etc. of the item, but it does not permit reproducing the material, performing it, or any of the copyright holder's other exclusive rights. Attribution is another area of confusion. People think if they just cite their source, they're good to go. But attribution is not a substitute for copyright permission. If the work is protected by copyright, you must obtain permission from the copyright holder or their agent in order to use it. And lots of people confuse the legal concept of the public domain with the fact that a work may be publicly available, such as information found in books or on the internet. The public domain comprises all those works that are either no longer protected by copyright or never were.
Oh, I see.
Most people do not intentionally violate copyright law. Like you, they are simply unaware of their responsibilities as they go about their everyday activities, which often involve the use and distribution of published information.
Is this a big problem?
Imagine millions of employees moving billions of documents around the world with no idea what their copyright responsibilities are. It kills me.
I guess it is a big problem. But does it really matter? I mean, who's going to know?
It matters for many reasons. First and foremost, it's the law. It's unlawful to infringe on the rights of copyright holders. They can sue for damages or to recoup lost profits as a result of infringement, which is costly and, well, looks bad for the company. It's also a matter of ethics. Demonstrating respect for the rights of copyright holders is simply the right thing to do. When we generate intellectual property, we want our rights respected, so we should respect the rights of others. And finally, copyright ensures the continued availability of the high-value material we rely on. Our needs are served by copyright holders' information development, and the royalties we pay fuel further development.
Very interesting. So what do we do when we want to use copyrighted information?
I'm always here to help, but the best advice I can give you is know the facts, remember your responsibilities, and when in doubt, get permission.
I, for one, am glad for that video. How many people appreciated that? All right. The reason it actually is, but let me tell you a couple of things. First of all, I appreciate that video because I don't have to tell you all that now. Jim did, and he told it to you at about twice the speed I would. All right. Jim has a Facebook page if you want to become a friend. And some people say that I may have had some influence on the creation of that. But in any case, if you do want to use that video, you're welcome to put it onto your company website, whatever. You can find it on our copyright.com/education site. I think it's on YouTube as well. So anybody who cares to help your colleagues understand some of the basics of copyright, you're free to do that. Copyright Clearance Center also holds regular webinars for the publishing community. If you are interested in joining us for one of those, which goes into much more depth about all of those points, it's an hour-long WebEx, free. Please come and see us after the program. All right, so the thing about confusion is that it's only natural. I was a reporter for many years in Northern Ireland, back in the days of what they called the Troubles. And we used to say that if you were confused, you were beginning to understand the problem, all right? That was a very confusing situation. It even mattered what you called the place. The confusion that surrounds copyright is really part of the problem and part of the solution, we like to think, because people have many different opinions about it. You've probably heard about everything from copyright to copyleft. And along the way, copyright has risen in the attention of the public to a tremendous degree, and that obviously is going to encourage a lot of different ideas floating around out there. I'll try to cover a few basic ones. And it's a pitch for both the publishers on this side of the room, the people who are reusing content. In publishing today, more and more people are reusing other kinds of content for illustrations, for anthologies, for all kinds of republication purposes. And so it's important to you to understand what you need to do if you are doing that, but it's also important to understand what your own rights are with respect to the published work that you have. Okay? So we'll start with a couple of copyright misconceptions. It says here, true or false, I suppose, a copyright compliance policy is sufficient. Well, of course, the answer to that is that only behavior and effective licensing can reduce infringement risk. Now, effective licensing does not mean beating the employees or anything if you catch them. What that means is that as a publisher, you have the exclusive right, as Jim pointed out, to your works and to the reuse of the works. Copyright can be thought of as a kind of a bundle of sticks, a bundle of rights that is infinitely divisible. And so in the instances where the work may be reused or repurposed, you as the publisher or the author, the copyright holder, have the right to license that work. You can do so for a fee, or you can make it available to somebody without a fee. The fee is not part of the licensing agreement, but the permission is the key there. You know, in the old days, back in the days of the photocopier, at least as I remember it, librarians and information professionals handled all the copyright questions. They were the gatekeepers. And as we know, in the world that's emerging from the internet, gatekeepers are going away. It's direct information supply to the person who is using that information. And so, as a result, what's happening out there is that most users don't know who to ask, and let alone what they should be asking about. Again, the video addressed some of that. How many people thought that, well, if it's online, it's free to use? Go ahead, admit it. We know you're holding back. We won't report you. But a great many people, certainly I can tell you that the generation that my daughter is a member of absolutely thinks that's the case. And she, I mean, years ago, introduced me, it was, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years ago, she was in the fourth grade or something, and introduced me to Google Images. At that point, I had been unaware that Google could do that sort of thing, and she was, you know, decorating all of her presentations with all those lovely photographs that were taken by my friend Steve and all the other photographers out there trying to make a living at doing that. So that generation certainly believes that there really isn't any reason to ask. Everything we do online, everything we do is online, so we have reduced copyright risk. Now, what I think about that misconception is it relates to the way we behave in traffic. I'm from Boston. It's hard to tell, but I am. And you may know that we have something of a reputation for being aggressive drivers. And I'm as good as anybody about that, let me tell you. And I find that something changes when you sit behind the wheel of a car and start moving at a good clip. You behave in ways that you wouldn't do if anybody could really see you. And, you know, signs that say speed limit 55 don't really matter so much. And indeed, I think that's what happens when people sit down at the desk or use the laptop or whatever. Because people can't see them, because they don't think they're being watched or could be identified, they behave in ways that they wouldn't do if they walked into a bookstore and picked up a book and walked out with it. It's probably not quite that bad, and I don't mean to imply there's a criminal behavior here, but there certainly is a respect for others that's implied in the same way that not speeding and behaving politely in traffic and, you know, knowing when to put your turn signals on, all of these things are part of a social contract, and copyright is a piece of that. Courtney got ahead of me here. Technology doesn't reduce risk. Right.
Sorry, Chris, I'm keeping you on track.
That's okay, right. No, she's in charge. If you thought I was in charge, Courtney is in charge of this program. We have standardized subscriptions for everything we need. Now, if you're in an office, I'm sure you get information of all kinds. And if you're a publisher, you may in fact provide your materials through subscription services. And so people believe that subscriptions cover everything for them. Once they have it, they're good to go. Now, of course, that's not true, that the licensing terms from publisher to publisher vary tremendously. What rights you may acquire when you get that material from publisher A will not be the same for publisher B. And the fact of the matter is, and we recognize it at Copyright Clearance Center, users will use whatever they find. And so you need to help them understand better what the licensing terms are as they get that content initially. We have a few more misconceptions. That publicly available material does not require permission. And there I believe that is just about stuff that's online. You have permission to turn off. That happened to me in a meeting once, and it was my mother, so I had to take the call. But publicly available material is still protected by copyright. Again, a point, if you are a publisher and you make material available online, and many publishers choose to do so, sample chapters from books, websites for the various authors, that kind of thing, we recommend, although it is not a requirement, as Jim pointed out, but we recommend that you put the copyright symbol, the year, and the owner of the copyright somewhere prominently on the web page. It strikes me as a mystery why so many people with websites of all kinds make it difficult to find out how to contact somebody, right? You want to know, you want to be in touch with them, you want to buy something, you want to get something, you want to learn more, and they make it almost impossible to be in direct contact. So the websites of Copyright Clearance Center and any of the ones that I really appreciate always have the information there. And if you put that on, it is a signal to people that you indeed want the copyright respected. And here's probably the last one. Oh, we're never going to get caught, right? Well, companies of all sizes get into trouble every week, all the time. How many people are familiar with the Legg Mason case? Have you ever heard of that? The details are online, but Legg Mason is a financial services firm that was sued for copyright infringement by a legal publisher. The original judgment was something like $17 million for infringement costs. Now, that is because with copyrighted material that's been registered with the Copyright Office in the United States, you can get what is known as statutory damages, sometimes triple costs. So these infringements can add up quite quickly. Now, that's one case you hear about. Many of the cases that go on happen sort of sub rosa. People don't know about it, but takedown notices, warnings about the reuse of content are issued by publishers and others all the time, every week. I mentioned to you that there's probably some surprise along the lines of global copyright, and that is this notion that there is indeed global copyright. Is that something anybody here subscribes to? Is there such a thing? No, there isn't. There are some treaties, and I'll tell you about them, but copyright is something that is subject to what we call national treatment. What that means is the behaviors that you may be familiar with in the United States, for example, will not apply in the UK or in Norway or in Australia. And so if you are doing business in different countries around the world, and increasingly, of course, publishers especially, but almost all businesses are global by their nature, you will find that behaviors will vary from country to country. It is especially difficult for US publishers to understand that some forms of statutory licensing in Europe make it possible for their works to be reused in ways that they wouldn't allow for in this country. I'll tell you briefly about the Berne Convention. The United States is one of the latest signatories to the Berne Convention in the late 1980s, but the original treaty goes back to the end of the 19th century. And we as a country did not sign on to the treaty for a variety of reasons, but having to do with the very different form of copyright legislation that we had, which required things like registering your copyright and other formalities. Copyright, as understood under the Berne Convention, and as Jim mentioned, is inherent in the creation of the work. Anytime a work is fixed, written down on a piece of paper, the back of a napkin, if you're writing notes for a conversation, you have the copyright to that. Likewise, it's in digital form, it is fixed in digital form, you have the copyright immediately. It is, again, strongly advised as publishers that you register all your published works with the U.S. Copyright Office. The fees have gone up recently on that. Courtney, with $50 for each registration?
I think it's $45 online.
$45 online. They are online. You can file those registrations if you're an author as well at copyright.gov. And we are copyright.com, so please don't confuse us with the Copyright Office. I see some questions. What I'm going to do is try to get through all of this and take as many questions at the end as possible from the audience, okay? So just hold on there about that. Let's see. Collective licensing, I mentioned briefly. Organizations that we know by their fabulous acronyms here. We are CCC. I prefer Copyright Clearance Center myself. Say the whole thing out loud. CLA is the Copyright Licensing Agency in the UK. Do we have any British visitors here with us today? Okay, CLA is an organization that includes the Newspaper Licensing Agency, authors groups, visual artist groups, and so forth. CIDRO is the organization that is our colleague organization in Spain, and as you know, of course, at BEA, there's the Global Market Forum on Spain going on. VG Wart is likewise the organization in Germany. And all of these, JRRC is for Japan, and there are literally dozens of organizations around the world, some more developed than others, as you might expect, more in countries where publishing is an important piece of the economy. And they are all collected under a non-governmental organization called IFRRO, I-F-R-R-O, thereby hangs a tail. It's the International Federation of Reproduction Rights Organizations. And Planned Parenthood is not a member. It is reproduction, meaning reprographic production, or reproduction, meaning any kind of republication, copying, essentially, of works. They're online at ifro.org if you want to learn about them. Global considerations, I've alluded to some of these points, that permission to use a copyrighted work in the U.S. does not mean you get permission to use that work outside the U.S. Permission to use English versions of a work does not include permission to translate that work. Translation is a separate right, just as performance is a separate right, just as the right that a novelist may have to create a screenplay from his or her novel is a separate work. So is the translation. And again, an issue which will come up in the Global Market Forum, and this afternoon I'll be moderating a discussion about licensing and foreign rights as part of that Global Forum. It's at 3 o'clock, so you can join me for that. And so we turn to the last section of the program, copyright today and tomorrow. Tomorrow? Is there going to be copyright tomorrow? How many people vote for copyright tomorrow? I do. But it's certainly an open question. All right? We'll lead off right now with another video. And yes, we did get permission to use this video.
Sorry, everyone, I just need to connect.
So if you're tweeting right now, you're going, there's a delay in the program. You know what I found interesting about tweeting? I don't know how many people do tweet. I do. As I say, Beyond the Book is on twitter.com. And what I find fascinating about that is, in the past, you were not able to know what the room was thinking about a presentation. I love that. If you're in a room and somebody is there talking to a couple of hundred people, you get to find out what the audience thinks right there and then. It's terrific.
All right, if all goes well,
here we go.
It's gonna work. Thank you.
It's thinking about it,
it's thinking.
Are you on?
Yep. So.
Good. You probably didn't want to hear my publishing jokes anyway, right?
It's a bummer.
All right. What did the bookstore clerk say to the customer?
This is embarrassing.
Are we bailing on that? I think we might.
Somebody's in cancer. Yeah,
I think we're going to bail on that. Thank you, Javits Convention Center. All right, now, I was going to ask you, what did the bookstore clerk say to the customer?
Where have you been?
That's good. All right. Yeah, everybody has to say, I don't know, Chris, what did the bookstore clerk say to the customer?
Oh, God.
Oh, God. All right. Well, what the bookstore clerk said to the customer was, what the heck are you doing here? Sorry. I was told that by a very senior executive at Random House, so I think I get to share that. He gave me permission to share that. Okay, so culture shift. Yeah, there's a culture shift for you. I was trying to show you a video. I think that one of the things that I've been talking with people about in terms of publishing in the future has been the emergence movement from the page culture to the screen culture. I think that people, readers of all kinds now, will be thinking more about screens, and publishers will be thinking about screens. In fact, you've got to be thinking, if you're in publishing, about a number of different screens right now. iPads, phones, the laptop, the television, all of these things will be part of what you will be thinking of as publishing. I presented something yesterday for the Independent Book Publishers Association there, and we talked about what's next in e-publishing. We had somebody there from Vook, which rhymes with book, and is creating what they call enhanced books. And enhanced by that, they mean with video and social media and so forth. And it really was fascinating to hear that publishers need to think beyond books. It's rather like Kodak had to stop thinking about themselves as being in the camera, the film business, and being in the image business. All right. So what we are seeing is a generation of content. We'll hold questions to the end, okay? As we say, content generation, it's the content generation, not the Pepsi generation anymore. Content generation, people create content themselves now. They don't just rely upon content to be created for them. All of this is revolutionizing the way that content goes back and forth, the way it's used and shared. It's fomented a very lively debate indeed, as I referred to the copyleft movement. How many of you might be familiar with copyleft or with Lawrence Lessig and Creative Commons and so forth? There are many different places on that spectrum. It's rather like a political debate in that, there may be people on the hard right, hard left, but there are a lot of people in the middle, and everybody has an opinion about what's the right thing to do. But the fact of the matter is that behaviors have changed forever. And we've got some examples to share around all of that. First of all, sharing is easier than ever. Oh, by the way, this is an early generation of the iPhone. In fact, if you go back, it would be the iPhone, the H phone, the G phone. This is a phone. It's just a phone, okay? That's called a dial. Anyway, so sharing is, in fact, easier than ever. Mobile devices have changed the way we live, of course. e-readers, the proliferation of devices is providing people with text in places and in ways that they never would have had it available before. Interesting to me is the way that the Kindle was meant as a book reader, but that many people are using it to read newspapers with it. So it is, you know, changing not just the book industry, but all forms of media exchange. And of course, social networks are providing ways for people to swap and share information of all kinds within these various so-called communities. You know, I could tell you about the proliferation of content today. Here are some numbers. First of all, the music industry, $20 billion industry in the year 2000. Today, 2010, a $10 billion industry. 95% of all songs downloaded last year went unpaid. Video. It says here that more video is out on YouTube in the last 2 months than if ABC, NBC, and CBS had aired new content 24/7, 365 since 1948. Images. Facebook, apart from having all of your private information, is now the largest photo repository in the world. And if anybody ever sees any of those photos, we're all in trouble, right? Okay. Journals, books, newspapers. In the last 5 years, unique readers of online newspapers are up 30 million. What's interesting, of course, is when we talk about the newspaper business, and no, that's not an oxymoron, the newspaper business is frankly, at least in one metric, more successful than ever. Every newspaper published today has more readers than ever. The Boston Globe has more readers than it ever had. The New York Times, The Guardian in the UK, all of these publications have more readers than ever. They just don't have very many subscribers left. Blogs. Now, this is something, you know, we worried about blogs a few years ago. Nobody really worries about them anymore, but there are, we say, 200 million blogs as of May 2010, and I think most of them haven't been updated since they were created. Podcasts. Some numbers from, I believe, Forrester say that 37 million people will be downloading from various podcasts by the year 2013. I expect that number must be much higher, really. Small plug there for Beyond the Book. We are reaching hundreds of subscribers, tens of thousands of downloads every month with our materials. Tremendous resource, I think, but again, a proliferation of content that would have been unimaginable only a few years ago. I mentioned Creative Commons. Are people familiar with Creative Commons? You certainly should be if you're in publishing. Creative Commons, very briefly, is a nonprofit organization like Copyright Clearance Center. We have worked together in the past. They have their own licensing model, not unlike ours, with some significant differences, of course. It provides free tools for copyright holders to grant permission to their work. Key point there is permission. It's for everything up to commercial. It makes it easier to share and build upon the works of others. There certainly is a cultural value in people creating based upon others' work. And that's certainly what Creative Commons tries to promote. And people who are familiar with Creative Commons know that that's, again, a part of that spectrum I spoke of, from copyright to copyleft. Creative Commons, some of them may be copyleft, some of them may be copyright. There are people who have been very willing to place material online on Flickr, for example, photographs and other things, but when they find out that the work is being used for commercial purposes, they want to be compensated for. Of course, there's the famous or infamous Google Book Settlement, which continues to keep lawyers busy and may well do so for some time yet to come. We have a timeline here. It may be something you're all familiar with. I hope indeed you are. Any day now we could have an announcement regarding the judge's ruling on the amended settlement. It could be months and months from now. But the suit goes all the way back to 2005, when the Authors Guild and AAP sued Google for the digitization project they called the Library Project, not to be confused with Google's partner programs. So in this sense, Google can wear a white hat and a black hat for many publishers. There was a settlement announced in October 2008. and that provided for a variety of things, access to works, centuries-old works, as well as out-of-print works. We can tell you all about the details here. If you are a copyright holder of any published work, a book, and you are not familiar with the terms of the settlement and haven't gone in to at least look whether you want to register your works with them, the site is googlebooksettlement.com. If you haven't done that yet, at least learn about it. We've got a number of podcast programs on Copyright Clearance Center that can help clarify many of the issues. And, you know, there will be more to come. The Department of Justice back in February expressed many of its concerns around the antitrust potential involved with the settlement itself. There was a fairness hearing regarding the proposed settlement in February, and there it all stands. So again, any day now we could learn about that. The judge could accept the settlement, enabling authors and publishers to make their works available, or he could reject it. He could tell them to go back and think about it. So we're all watching that very, very closely indeed. But again, it gives you an idea of the way that copyright is under a kind of earthquake scenario. Every day, tremendous changes can happen that can change the landscape forever. And when the dust settles on the Google Book settlement, that will indeed be the case. So that's why I ask you, copyright tomorrow? We've seen this copyrighted content explosion, the orphan works problem. Are people familiar with that term? I'm calling these to your attention because I think as publishers or as authors, you want to be aware of it at least. I saw some hints. Orphan works essentially are works where the copyright holder cannot be found or identified. It may be that we know the name of the company that created the film or published the book, but they've long gone out of business. And in the case of things like photographs, some audio recordings, the copyright holders are entirely unknown. And it is putting into limbo millions and millions and millions of works which are unavailable because the permission cannot be granted. And as I mentioned, those digital natives, that's what we call my daughter's generation, they will be entering the workforce shortly, working with machines rather like this one here, or maybe not. And then there is something coming, which is the cloud. People familiar with this term, publishing in the cloud. That will mean that you will have access to a virtual bookshelf of works of all kinds. Google Editions is a part of that. You maybe have heard about that. But the cloud computing means that it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter what device you're on, your access to your bookshelf, to your own personal library, will be available to you 24/7. That will, again, change the way we think about published works. And it's something to be watched for very closely by all of us. So what we're trying to suggest with this program, and I look forward to your questions, is that copyright is as important as it ever has been. The creative economy in this country is driving much of the growth in our economy. And the Copyright Clearance Center, we really truly believe that respect for intellectual property is going to benefit all of us. Be aware, because it's a global industry now, that copyright law varies from country to country. And I think it's important to understand, if you don't already, I'm sure you do, that publishing today isn't about words on the page. It's about technology. I mean, HTML5, right? Who ever thought that you'd be at Book Expo talking about XML and HTML5 and all of that. So the technology and publishing are partners forever, and it will change the way that people access their content, whether it's in book form or any other form. So I really appreciate your attention, and I want to, if I can, take as many questions as possible from the audience here. I've got a microphone. I can kind of step down off the podium here, make it a little more friendly. Since you're right in front.
All right.
And we'll just do that. What? All right. You want to tell us who you are and what's your question?
Yeah, okay. I'm Steve Hoberman with Technis Publications, and I sign a number of agreements with authors, and sometimes the author wants to own the copyright. And what's the difference between the publisher owning the copyright and the author owning the copyright, but the publisher's given exclusive rights?
There's a big difference, of course. And what I should say, first of all, is I'm not an attorney, and I don't write contracts. So I can tell you, as an author, it matters a great deal to me. But as a publisher, you have your own interests there. It's a negotiation process. I mean, the one thing that we say at Copyright Clearance Center is that all of these things really are negotiable. The original creator of the work, of course, does have the exclusive rights. Now, in the case of authors, it may be the author has come to you after they've written the work and wish to publish it with you. They would be the copyright holder at that point. But as a publisher, you may be wanting to create a series of books on a certain topic. And you may then have to go and find authors who can write on that particular topic. So, you know, art history or whatever it might be. In that case, it would be entirely reasonable that you would want to be the copyright holder as publisher for that. And so you would be paying them essentially in a work for hire arrangement, to which they would obtain no rights at all. They would just get paid for the work. That makes sense? Sure. And if it ends up not being able to reach, then we'll just have to rephrase the question. But I'm going to try to do that.
Elizabeth Riddler, Brooklyn Public Library, librarian. I'm very interested. I'm on the American Library Association Governing Council, and we've been following the Google settlement very closely. And one of the new issues that I see emerging is the ignoring by the U.S. courts of Canadian and U.K. copyright, because the Google settlement is an American settlement, but it's including Canadian and British works. They've excluded other nationalities. I'd like to hear your response on that.
Well, you know, what I know is what the court tells us. The original settlement was, in effect, a global settlement. In the course of the commenting period that was open after the settlement was announced in October of 2008, many organizations, many countries, several governments actually weighed in with their opinion. As I remember, the French government, the Germans, I'm sure others involved as well did. And so what happened was the original settlement was amended. So we had settlement number one. The current settlement number two did in fact sort of pull back from global and included mainly English language works from the countries you mentioned, and there may be one or two others. Australia may be in there as well. So that is a matter, it's a class action lawsuit. And so the class action lawyers have crafted the settlement, which is not uncommon in class action cases. And it is entirely up to the judge to accept it or not. And then once that's been accepted, the Department of Justice may become involved if it does sort of see that the antitrust concerns have not been addressed. So it's the definition of a continuing story. And I can't tell you more than that. And we all, as I say, await the decision of the judge.
Has the Copyright Clearance Center had discussions with any of the stakeholders in the potential Google settlement over participating, representing the publishers you represent on the rights registry in some manner?
Well, to say about that, the question was about the settlement and how Copyright Clearance Center may become involved. We are not parties to the settlement. We are certainly partners with many of the people involved, from the Authors Guild membership to the AAP's members. And, you know, if somebody called on us to work with them, we would be happy to. But just to clarify, Copyright Clearance Center is not a party and has no specific interests in that settlement. And in fact, I can say, I think, that what we do has a kind of overlap or we will be in very much the same kind of space in terms of licensing as to what the proposed book rights registry will be doing. Yeah, well, I guess we're going to... one more with the microphone.
Yeah. And tell us who you are and what's your question.
Yeah, my name is Sriram and I do some writing. You gave us a joke today about the iPhone and the A phone. I want to put it in a book of mine and publish it. Do I need your permission, and did you steal it from somebody else?
Well, I always tell people I get my ideas in one of two places, right? I either think of them, or I steal them. And that's copyright Chris Keneally, 2010. I have another one of my copyrighted observations, which is, what's the opposite of work? I asked my daughter this one time, and she looked at me and said, well, play, Dad. I said, no, the opposite of work is meetings. And that is copyright 2010 Chris Keneally. Actually, it's not, because you know why? It's not written down. I've never actually written any of those lines down.
It's recorded.
But you're right, it's recorded. But I think that's Copyright Book Expo America.
So if you put that as a status on Facebook, then it would be written down.
I mean, I think if you politely asked me permission, you could do that. But the permission would still be required, if I recall your question now. Yes, indeed. Permission would still be required for that kind of thing. And I think, again, it's about that notion of respect, that copyright clearance center respect.
Where's your meeting?
It's in the room where all the Global Forum is. It's on the other side of the Escalades there. I'm sorry, I don't know the number of the
room. Did you get that?
E-113. And I've lost track. E-113. And I've lost track of time, so I don't want to go over.
It's five of.
Five of. If people want to stay and you have another question or two, please, if you I have to go and you haven't given us your card, please do so. We'd be happy to get you more information. But I'll be happy to take one or two more questions. Yes.
My name is David Deal with Molly Woolley. I was wondering if you could comment on the importance of trademarking. After you published and copyright your book, if you have a titled character, is it important to trademark the name or anything?
Well, I can answer it this way. If you're the Disney company, you think it's important. So if the Disney company thinks it's important and they trademark every single character in all their films, I would suggest that you attempt to do so. Trademark is a form of consumer protection, as a matter of fact, so that we know that Coca-Cola really is the real thing, right? So I can't address it because I don't know the details of it, but I would certainly think if you think there's a licensing value to the characters you're creating, you should certainly look into that. One more question.
Well, it's turned out.